Welcome to the Hoban Minute, a podcast that will shift your perspective on the business, politics, and culture of the hemp and marijuana industries. I'm your host, Xavier Jaye. It's 420 somewhere, so let's dive in. Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Hoban Minute. This is your host, Xavier, and I am joined today, as I always am, by Bob Hoban.
Hey now, good to be here. How are you today?
I'm doing all right. How about yourself?
Good. It's years off to an interesting start.
A roaring start.
A roaring start indeed. And it's a mixed bag, but we've got plenty to talk about.
Yeah, no, some good, some bad, and let's jump right in. So a little bit of an unconventional start. We're going to start with some of the bad. We're going to talk about the pain that the industry is currently experiencing. We all know that there was a lot of hope riding on, I think it was maybe the seventh or eighth iteration of the Safe Banking Act passing at the end of last year. That didn't happen. There was some hope that that would help clear things up, provide some capital relief to the cannabis industry and operators in kind. But of course, it didn't happen. And so we're kind of entering another, let's say, doldrum period where there's not really a light at the end of the tunnel, per se, you know, until the next election, maybe. Presidential election. But right now, you know, you actually just wrote an article posted on Forbes today comparing the cannabis industry and kind of the growth that we've seen of the cannabis industry over the last 10 years to the life cycle, the early life cycle of the tech industry, the dot-com boom that we saw in the late 90s into the early 2000s. And so what is that trend? And, you know, how is cannabis aligning with the tech boom? And how is it perhaps maybe differing, and what does that mean for, you know, the future, the next 5 years?
That's a great question. So that is the quest I was on, to sort of see if there's anything instructive about the tech boom and the tech bubble bust that happened about 10 years into the tech boom. And when you look at that, there are a lot of parallels, because contrary to what you might read or much you might hear, the cannabis industry is not going anywhere. It's not going to fall apart and just wither into nowhere. It's an opportunity to regroup. So some of the things that I noticed, so you've got this tech boom, the dot-com boom, if you will, which was the first 10 years, starting in about 1990, run roughly through 2000, although that bubble bust in 2001. So what are the same things that happened in the first 10 years? And that's really where we are in the cannabis industry. We're 10 years into a commercial regulated cannabis industry. Now, the difference is we might have an over-regulated, over-taxed structure. That didn't necessarily occur in the tech space, certainly not at the outset. That was kind of applied retroactively. But what you had was very, very quick expansion and contraction over 10 years, primarily expansion. You had an industry that was based on various fields. We talk about it as tech, but it's really finance, it's technology, it's science, it's hardware, it's software. It's a combination of multiple fields, much like the cannabis industry, which also takes into account technology, finance, you know, cultivation, retail, marketing, branding, all of these things that fell in line at the same time. It was, of course, a tremendous disruptor when you look at the tech bubble and the tech boom, much like the cannabis industry was disruptive. People invested in a frenzy because of the fear of missing out, largely. I mean, there's no other way to explain the fact that people invested so much money on crazy, if even absurd, pre-revenue valuations with such little due diligence based on that fear of missing out and or based on the thought that there's going to be a tremendous first mover advantage, which we really didn't see in the tech boom, nor did we really see in the cannabis, first 10 years of the cannabis industry boom. You had years of layoffs. In other words, jobs were created and then jobs began to be cut year after year after year in those waning years of the first 10 years up until 2001. You had double-digit inflation. You had a number of things occur that led people to say that the dot-com bubble has burst and this industry is over. we're sitting here today, we're on our cell phones, we're on the social media, we're on all forms of technology that were created and sort of promoted and really exploded during the tech boom. So I would suggest very strongly, just like that, cannabis isn't going anywhere. But the thing that's interesting is all of these companies want to be the Amazon or the Google of the cannabis industry, you know, so to speak. You know, a large aggregator that's global in scope. We saw that with Canopy Growth, Tilray, so forth and so on. And we've seen the struggles of those companies. Well, remember, in 2001, nobody knew who Amazon really was. Yep. In 2001, there was no Google. So these are the things that I think we need to sort of zoom out a little bit and take some perhaps consolation in and just understand that these things are natural and that this industry will have this ebb and this flow and it will come back around, but things have to be done differently going forward. So then that sort of sets the table for how does the industry today, where there is investment and where there is growth, and there's absolutely growth. The industry is continuing to grow, both domestically and globally. But how can those new actors, those new movers, avoid some of these pitfalls? What are the pitfalls? What are the parallels with what I read about the other day with MedMen? Mm-hmm. You had a company that was valued at almost $2 billion, traded publicly, that now has maybe, I think I read, 25 million in assets. Well, that sounds like a large number, but not up against $165 or $170 million in liabilities. So that, and therein, I think, lies the conundrum. How do you build a business that's not over-engineered, that's not overdone, that delivers the production supply chain that's required state by state by state, and becomes profitable and stays profitable without taking on enormous amounts of debt?
Yeah.
What is that debt? Where was that debt? Look at MedMen. Maybe not a great example because there's some nefarious behavior behind MedMen, but it's a good example of what happens when a company grows really, really fast. How do these companies avoid taking on substantial debt? How do they produce a lean and mean, if you will, business model? How do they remain profitable? Is it even possible when you're thinking about the fact that, all right, New Jersey's going adult use. We're looking at all of these different operators going in with licenses and building things out, maybe over-engineering their cultivation, sinking lots and lots of money into branding, marketing, and the retail experience. But how can those companies, knowing what we know now, avoid the pitfalls of the MedMen or, frankly, the first 10 years of the tech boom?
No, I think that's a good question and something that, you know, maybe we can actually impart some wisdom on our listeners with is kind of how to avoid that growth. And I do think that that initial wave of MSOs, multi-state operators, you know, the MedMens, and then even some of the Canadian LPs that you mentioned, Canopy Growth, they were focused on license acquisition. Right. To them, the end game was having as many licenses as possible in as many diverse jurisdictions around the world as possible.
Revenue didn't matter.
No.
It was just, let's just own as many of these assets as possible.
Right. Eventually, the connections would be made, and then all of a sudden, you'd have this global brand and presence. Those connections haven't been made, and so none of those companies have realized truly that kind of goal or that dream. So I think the lesson to be learned now for the modern operator or for the operator that's maybe looking at a New Jersey or a new state, Arizona, right, that's recently flipped from medical to rec or has introduced medical marijuana for the first time. While we were talking about pain earlier, there still is this sense of excitement and, you know, kind of participation in a new unforeseen industry. It's a historical event. And I think the most important thing for those operators that are getting into the industry, that are excited to participate, is to focus on their core competencies. It's to focus on retail. It's to focus on cultivation. It's to focus on manufacturing. Not all three, but one of the three. Pick one. What are you good at? And do that. Own that. Develop that brand. Develop those products. Find, you know, the consumer loyalty that's required. And then once you have that concept proofed in a particular state, you can then take that and go maybe to another place and say, hey, we've done this here. Why don't we consider doing it in this state? And let's look at that. holistically. Let's be smart about that. Let's find the right partners. Let's not just go and acquire assets, because at the end of the day, all that matters is having as many assets as possible under one roof. Instead, let's focus on the operations. You know, like you said, lean and mean, making sure that you are generating revenue, that there is, you know, kind of reliable growth of the business, and that there's something that you're doing. I think this is something that's told to entrepreneurs all the time, right? There's some niche that you're filling, some problem you're solving, some desire from consumers or other licensed operators that you're addressing, right? And then honing in on that, owning it, and doing it better than everybody else.
Yes. But there was also the little bit of the color is if I was Canopy Growth and I spent $2 billion aggregating all these assets all over the U.S. and around the world, if the federal government had legalized contemporaneous with the, you know, aggregation and control of those assets, then Canopy Growth was sitting pretty.
Certainly.
Because in theory, you know, like a Procter & Gamble of the world or some large institutional company with experience in the space or in, you know, selling things to consumers and the like would have bought it for billions and billions of dollars. So it was a bet. And
but was that a reasonable bet? Do you think that was ever
a reasonable
business plan?
You know, let me say this. I recall one of the first conferences, maybe 2013, that was really, really notable in terms of its size. It was in Chicago. It was at the Millennium Hilton on the Millennium Park. And there was a lot of people there. It was one of the first conferences where I went, wow, this is really bringing people from all over the place. And I sat in on one of those panels, and Brendan Kennedy, founder, maybe the original founder of Tilray, he sat on one of these panels, and when asked the question, when's federal legalization going to happen, he says, I believe it's going to happen within 18 months.
Wow. Based on what?
Yeah. What? What? You know, and you still hear some predictions, oh, it's going to happen within 3 years or otherwise.
This is 2013, you said?
This was 2013, if I'm not mistaken. It could have been 2015, it was 7, 8, it was a long time ago
in
cannabis years. So the bet was not well-founded. It was not placed based on real information, because where would you have gotten that from? Nobody had that information. That was pure speculation, and maybe that was speculation to drive investment. Now, the other side of the coin, to your point, which is a really good one, you don't have to go out and own everything. You have to have something everywhere, do something really well in a particular location. Mm-hmm. So we saw Curaleaf announce last week that they were shutting down operations in multiple states, California being one of them, Colorado, maybe Arizona. But the point is they were shutting down multiple stores. We're seeing that happen in multiple states through multiple companies. But is that necessarily a terrible thing?
No.
Or is that just we grew too far too fast? We refused to do, for example, like what Native Roots has done in the state of Colorado. You've got a company like Native Roots and a company like LiveWell that just focus on one market, and they build it out as strong and robust, and they own it. They're not trying to say, okay, well, I'll put 4 in this state, 3 in this state, 2 in this state. Now, again, if your bet is federal legalization, then you've got a national footprint, and you've created a business that's very, very, very lucrative and worth a ton of money. But that bet was never placed based on real information, because here we are today with still no federal legalization and the fact that companies have to retreat and withdraw. But again, I don't say that's a weakness. I don't look in the rearview mirror and go, they should have known. Brendan Kennedy should have known when he said that on that stage he was wrong, because we're all talking about what could happen in the future.
Yeah.
But I do question some of the people that made those large-scale decisions, that made those bets and deployed billions of dollars on behalf of investors that were, you know, all rosy-eyed about this industry, because it was never a real possibility, not under Obama, not under Bush, not under our current president. So here we go, and certainly not under our former president. So here we are many years later looking at what looks like ruins. But in reality, these are assets. And those assets will continue to have value and be aggregated by people that perhaps can build a better business model that is focused on what? Revenue.
Right. Actual revenue. Yeah, not just having licenses. And I've always, you know, for me, I've always zoned in on one particular activity within the cannabis context too, and that's cultivation. You know, it's too funny to me looking at, I don't know, the big MSOs out there that have these state-of-the-art controlled environment agriculture facilities.
In multiple states.
Oh, in Maine, in New Hampshire, and then in Massachusetts. It takes 3 hours to drive from all three of those facilities. And believe it or not, cannabis does not grow in the Northeast. Once it's federally legal, it's not going to be cultivated up in the Northeast. It's going to be cultivated along, you know, the agricultural belt, and then it'll be distributed and used like an agricultural commodity like corn to create products, right? And so it's just like too funny to me looking at the development of these facilities and, you know, thinking critically, like, okay, like, well, what are you going to do once we do have federal legalization? You should put, you know, you have this 100,000 square foot canopy cultivation facility, start at state of the art. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's not going to grow cannabis any cheaper than the sun and the dirt down where cannabis likes to grow. And so it's, I don't know, it's ironic, I think, and it's kind of indicative, again, of that first wave where all you had to do was acquire licenses, because a lot of the time those license processes required you to have a fully built out facility, or at least have identified, you know, kind of the plans and the design to do so. And then as soon as you got that license, you have, you know, 6 months, 12 months to put everything together and have plants in the ground, which, you know, again, has led to the creation of all these commercial facilities in places where they don't belong.
Well, and it's also a product of the fact that it's a brand new industry. So you got to create a supply chain before you can sell one product. That costs money, that takes time, and people want to do it, quote unquote, the right way. But you don't know what your neighbor's doing because there's no central trade association that's effective. There's no central clearinghouse of information to say there are 10 new cultivation facilities being built in South Central Maine right now. You might look at doing something else. It really was not easy to find out right. That information. So you didn't know that until you just spent $18 million or $30 million on a state-of-the-art facility. So it's that fragmentation that has led us to really have all of these challenges. Those buildings will be repurposed. That equipment will be put to good use. Nothing's going to go to waste, but it's not going to be the end-all, be-all as these visionaries, these business leaders, these decision makers, these investors thought that it would be.
Yeah. Well, and so let's talk about that. Let's talk about, you know, how we do create or, you know, use existing structures to create kind of that clearinghouse of cannabis information. You know, earlier today we were talking about events, right? And how in the context of this downturn and contraction in the cannabis space, you were observing that, if anything, the events were, you know, better populated, better attended, you know, more vibrant and exciting than they'd been any time prior. And so are physical gatherings and events the way that the industry effectively can transfer this information? I mean, is there a way that we can take what's done at the local personal level and then, you know, share that in a proper fashion that can actually, you know, be accessible?
Events tend to be, as you suggest, the clearinghouse for information, for meeting people. Myself, so many people in the industry, we've built literal careers and businesses based on attending regularly cannabis events around the globe, because being there, seeing someone face to face, them being able to validate what you say you are and what you're doing, because they can go online and see a track record that's 6, 8, 10, 14 years old, and see thought leadership and the like. That's where people meet people in this industry, financiers, service providers, strategic partners, and the like. And that continues to be the case. And I'll stand by that until it's not the case anymore. And once you think events are waning in terms of their influence, oh, MJ BizCon, nobody goes to that anymore. Nobody goes to it when the economy's good and everybody's got what they need. But when the economy's not good, everybody's on the floor, everybody's there looking for that connection, that partner, that potential relationship, talking to as many people as possible. So I stand by that as the way to both become educated and to do business development, no matter what element of the business you're in, because you can understand what's happening and you do have to gather the information yourself and you can't stay siloed. You know, there are, using our experience, we work at a law firm. We have a certain piece of the pie, if you will, of the cannabis industry that's substantial. Those people are coming across our desk every single day. not just clients, but people that we work with, other service providers, other lawyers. Well, there's other law firms that have a similar piece of the pie. Those pieces of the pie don't always overlap. Mm-hmm. The way to get them to overlap so you can get information and to potentially find something you're looking for is to go to the events and go to the conferences. And as you suggest, they're better attended, I think, than they've ever been in the last 4 or 5 years, certainly, but maybe in the history of the industry. And that is the place to go. So for those folks looking to get into the industry, looking for something in the industry, why would I go there? That's a shit show. I'm not going to go out on the floor. I don't need lights and labels, which is, you know, sort of the simplified way of suggesting sometimes what's on a showroom floor in the cannabis industry. But you need the people. You need to meet the people. And you never know who you're going to meet. And I can, you know, speak to that because I've met some of the finest people in the industry, some of the most successful people outside of the industry that are looking at the industry, and some of our closest friends and clients by walking around trade shows all around the world. And I think that that's going to continue to be relevant. But Xavier, to your point, without some sort of central organization or clearinghouse of information or a really effective national or international trade group, you got to go get it yourself, and that's the way to do it. Yeah. So when you look at ICBCs and you look at, you know, these events, the Benzinga events, and not to leave anybody out, I'm sort of just talking off the top of my head, but my point is we know there are substantial events that attract a lot of people and that this is global in scope. That's the place that you have to be if you really want to make any sort of progress in this industry, certainly if you want baseline foundational information. And by the way, I don't know the answer to this. What were events like in those first 10 years of the dot-com boom?
Great question.
Because it's probably the exact same way. I'd bet almost anything on it.
Yeah. No, I bet, you know, some equipment providers that were frowned upon and hardware hawkers, if you will, that were selling product. And,
consumer electronics shows, right. That
kind of gimmicky.
This is where it all happened.
Right. No, and I think to your point too, the ability to be physically present with people allows you, you know, not only to identify the good actors and the people that you want to work with, but also kind of sniff test everybody and say, oh, I was thinking about working with this person, but saw their booth and it doesn't look anything like their website, or, you know, they weren't able to look me in the eye and have a good conversation. So maybe I don't want to work with them. And so often it is true that you have to have kind of that ability to qualify someone and meet the person and not just, you know, engage with the service or the product and develop that personal relationship. So I want to finish with just a piece of kind of, you know, recent news. The FDA did come out and officially declined to regulate or pass any sort of rulemaking procedure when it comes to cannabinoids, specifically cannabidiol CBD. You, I think, you know, have made that clear for years that they're not going to do that, and there's no reason to do so. So what are your thoughts? Is that, you know, is that news? Is that just more of the status quo? Does it change anything?
It's certainly news because we were led to believe by two prior FDA commissioners, both Hahn and Interim Commissioner Gottlieb, that a pathway would be created because it would be effectively folly to go back on CBD, right? CBD sort of being representative of cannabinoids from the hemp plant. Those two former commissioners were in leadership positions. And presumably, I don't know what happens every day at the FDA, but presumably those folks had sent that message down to the people at the FDA, the rank and file, the people responsible for certain development of certain rules and programs, to suggest that, yes, we're going to proceed with this. In fact, we developed one of the first hemp food programs here in Colorado, first by way of policy, then it was ultimately signed into law by the governor because of our efforts on behalf of our clients. Now, the FDA hired away several of those people from our CDPHE, our state FDA equivalent. We know they went there to work specifically on this issue. But I was always doubtful. We've never seen any movement. And frankly, if you're a legal mind and you know anything about the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, you would know that there's really not a direct path to creating rules around products that have never been in our nutritional slash food supply chain, nor have been recognized as, you know, a historical supplement or dietary supplement ingredients. And those are significant things. So absent leadership from the top, you're looking at a situation where you're asking FDA rank and file officials to create rules. Rules on what? These things do not pass muster under the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act because they have never been in the food supply chain in any notable commercial quantities prior to recent years on the nutritional or the food side. And on the supplement side, they've never been recognized as safe ingredients or generally recognized ingredients that could be utilized in a pharmaceutical product or, pardon me, a supplement product, let alone a pharmaceutical product. And then furthermore, there's this sort of notion that there's a race to find a compound in a remote location in the world and identify it as an ingredient in a pharmaceutical product first. And if you've done that and you beat the supplement manufacturers and the nutritional food ingredient manufacturers to the punch, so to speak, then it becomes a pharmaceutical lane product only. So I'm talking in very, very general terms here. So
does that race actually happen? You know, is there, yes. The FDA doesn't presume to know and identify.
No, the FDA doesn't. The FDA doesn't affirmatively go right. out and do
anything. No, sure.
Right. But if
people are hunting.
But if I went into the Brazilian rainforest and I found a root and I realized that that root helped with condition X and I brought that root back to the United States. So if I'm a pharmaceutical formulator and I pursue the addition and use of that root as a ingredient in a pharmaceutical compound for a specific purpose before anyone ever uses it as a supplement ingredient that's recognized and legal and permitted, then it becomes a pharmaceutical channel only ingredient. Mm. But if it gets used in the other fields first, then it could be utilized effectively on both sides. Again, very, very general discussion here, sure, about what the law is. There's a whole lot more nuance to all of that. But my point is, given all of that, this is no surprise. You want FDA rank and file employees to go out on a limb, create a new pathway for a controversial product that has no precedent in being in our food or supplement supply chain, based on a lack of safety or toxicity data over a long period of time. Not going to happen. It was never going to happen when push came to shove. So at the end of the day, the FDA is asking Congress for direction. And will Congress provide it direction? There's been some movement previously from people that were trying to put up bills to say, we're going to go regulate cannabinoids from hemp if you don't do it, FDA, or we're going to force you to do it if you don't want to do it. And now they're going to be presumably forced to do it. But that's going to take political leadership from a politician, from a floor vote in Congress, unless, of course, there's a new FDA commissioner or a president that tells the executive branch, we need to push these things forward as a matter of policy without new legislation, which is possible under some nuances based on constituent part analysis, but that's a whole nother discussion for another day. In other words, not likely.
Got it. And so you think the FDA would create a new category to regulate such products under, or would it be, you know, would it be more changing the definitions of the category to be able to include?
They're bending and twisting existing definitions in a really distorted and stretched manner to get the industry what it wants. And that's always been the case. Now, again, if one of these former commissioners were in charge today and that was the mandate from the top, figure out a way to regulate these products because they're out there in the marketplace and we want to make sure that what people are consuming, because they're consuming it, is safe and produced consistently in a quality manner. Then, yes, there could be some distorted policy interpretations. But absent that leadership, which we don't have right now with Director Woodcock at the FDA, I tell you what, it's just, frankly, no surprise. Mm. The surprise will be what Congress does with it. And let's not forget, the Farm Bill comes around this year. So the Farm Bill, which is the first piece of federal legislation beginning in 2014, then subsequently renewed in 2018 with no restrictions whatsoever, That has to be renewed this year. What's going to happen? We have a bit of an idea about what's going to happen there, but will it raise the THC limit for hemp plants? Will it ban intoxicating compounds that are produced from the hemp plant? Will it be silent on all of the above and leave that to the FDA? Probably the latter, by the way. But that's the scenario we're dealing with. And let's face it, I've said this example 100 times. It took almost 20 years for the FDA to regulate nicotine vape products. In those early days, they were poison. They were being produced in a way that really harmed people. Hopefully today that's better with FDA regulations. I don't know that specifically. But my point is, the FDA does not move quickly. No government agency, no federal government agency moves quickly to address an existing problem unless you have, you know, people dying and tremendous criminal behavior around that thing, quite literally. And I don't think we see a lot of that, but that's the way sometimes it's painted.
Yeah, and that's why it's so important for the, you know, industry's existing self-regulation to continue and for folks to continue to seek cGMP certifications and ensure that they are putting the right ingredients and products into their products that are going to be consumed by, you know, folks around the United States. So that's definitely important. Finishing thought here for you. It's, you know, I'm usually prohibited from stating anything that might date these episodes, but it is Super Bowl week and you are a Philly Eagles fan. So
yeah, birds.
Yeah. And so, you know, closing thoughts, what's your message to the team and who's winning on Sunday?
I think the Eagles are going to win, but not just win. I think they're going to win big. I really do. As an Eagles fan, as a Philadelphia sports fan, I'm used to being disappointed. But I don't think that that's going to be the case this year. I think we're looking at 38-24 as the final score, with the Eagles on top for their second Super Bowl in less than 10 years. But also, on a sports note, and let's not take a dramatic turn, we do have to compliment King James. LeBron James did break the all-time scoring record the other night. And what makes me super happy about that was there was a renewed focus on the debate concerning the GOAT, the greatest of all time. And, you know, that discussion has always centered around Michael Jordan and LeBron James. You bring other people into the discussion.
Not Larry Bird?
Well, there's Larry Bird. There's so many. That's my point, right? There's so many other great players. It's really just, it's fun to talk about it over a drink. But at the end of the day, I love the renewed focus on Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. His grace, his style, his presence, his class. This guy, he very well may be the greatest of all time. A six-time MVP, the leading scorer for almost 40 years in NBA history. A guy who won at high school, at college, in the pros. He was a consummate professional, not always the easiest guy to get along with. But at the end of the day, that is what makes me happy about this entire debate. And congratulations to LeBron James, because you got to stay healthy and you got to have a long, long career and continue to be in command. And I think he's got many years left.
I do. I think so too. And I think that you know, that scoring title will not be taken by anyone else for a very long time. Unless, you know, we do continue to see athletes using supplements and the training regimes that we see, and they're playing into their 50s and their 60s. But at this point, you know, it's truly an impressive achievement. Good job, LeBron. I would say I'm a fan, but I'm not. But still, I think it's an impressive achievement. And fly, Eagles, fly.
Go Birds.
Thanks for joining us for another enlightening conversation. If you liked what you heard, hit that subscribe button to get all future episodes fresh out of the studio. Suggestions for topics or guests for the show, please send them to hello@bobhoban.com. And, as always, thanks to Benzinga for powering the Hoban Minute.